You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid access, which cost the government billions. We'll talk to a researcher who says that move helped lower costs in other areas.
First, we're talking about the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend. White supremacists and others gathered for a so-called Unite the Right march in Charlottesville on Saturday. Counter-protesters also turned out, and taunting led to shoving, and after that, to violence. Then a car plowed into a group of counter-protesters, leaving one woman dead and 19 others injured. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe declared a state of emergency. In total, at least 34 people were injured in the clashes.
We want to hear what you think about the news now at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to what happened over the weekend? What did you make of the president's response both today and over the weekend? What kind of action do you think should be taken in the face of the next white supremacist rally? And what would you like to see, if anything, from the federal government? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Chad Dion Lassiter is a national expert on race relations and a professor of race relations at Westchester University. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
I want to start today with audio of some of the chanting from the white supremacists and others from Friday night as they marched through the University of Virginia campus.
You will not replace us! You will not replace us! You will not replace us!
You will not replace us! You will not replace us is the chant. What do you make of that chant? What is the meaning behind it?
I think the meaning of this is individuals who are somewhat anxious and really afraid and fearful that as we move forward in our democracy, we're talking about the browning of America and that the world may become a little bit more browner and a little bit more equitable. And so the "you will not replace us" is a fear that some whites have that whites will one day be in the minority.
Well, we are, as you said, at this juncture in history when the majority are becoming the minority, looking at the browning of America. And how do you think we can, as a country, face moments like this and make that reaction and that transition constructive and not like it was on Saturday, not destructive?
I think we're just going to have more whites of racial consciousness who can speak back to this in a nonviolent way. Janet Helms talks often about white identity development or white identity models. And the white identity model has to be rooted in white pride, but not from a superiority standpoint, but to be proud to be white. But in a society that oftentimes benefits from white privilege, oftentimes whites have a strong ethnic identity, but they don't have a strong racial identity. So I think just having more conversations around racial identity, but I'm not saying that that's the panacea. We have some deeply rooted problems in our democracy.
I think that some people would hear you say white identity model and even the notion that it's okay to embrace that on some levels, certainly not all, but on some levels would recoil from that because it seems to have with it this history that we saw manifested on Saturday of intolerance sometimes and racism.
Yeah, certainly. When we talk about Asian pride, African-American pride, Latino pride, Jewish pride, it's not rooted in superiority, and is also not rooted in inferiority. But there are ways that we can talk about those white abolitionists like John Brown, those white civil rights leaders during Martin Luther King and others' era who actually fought for black humanity and all humanity. And so you're absolutely right. What we saw in Charlottesville is not the reality of what I'm talking about as it relates to white pride. Sometimes people want to be on one side or the other, and they fail to realize that there are ways that we can speak back to this, and we need to also make sure that we hold ourselves accountable and that we're not lending to more of these type of behaviors as well by race baiting.
I want to talk a little bit about the reaction of President Trump. He on Saturday had this to say.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country.
He said on many sides, and that was the language that earned him a lot of criticism. And on this Monday afternoon, he said this.
Racism is evil. And those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
So a much more pointed rebuke in that second clip. Chad, what do you hear when you hear those two responses from the President of the United States back to back?
I don't view either of the clips as having any authenticity. It didn't come from his belly. It didn't come from his soul, similar to what we heard Marco Rubio articulate, what John McCain articulated, and what the governor of Virginia articulated. This is a president who oftentimes provides some of the same chants that we heard, some of the same xenophobic, some of the same racist, some of the same homophobic language. And so white supremacists, they feel emboldened by a president that does not condemn them. And now that it's gotten away from him, his speechwriter, his advisors, they got together and they probably provided this crafted, you know, statement for him. Nothing like what Vice President Pence said. He was more poignant. He was more in your face. He said our democracy has some problems and white supremacy, we need to denounce it at all costs.
And the New York Times echoed a little bit what you just said there, Chad. They used the term President Trump as bowing to pressure in that stronger language, condemning white supremacists and bowing to pressure, if that's an accurate read on it. If you are someone who agrees with that, that seems to be a more reactive instead of proactive. But given all that, this is the president of the United States. Does this message still have power?
I'm not certain if this president's message has power simply because he placates, he ingratiates, and he displays with false generosity. I think the power is within the people. I think the power is what Marco Rubio said and what John McCain said and what the governor said and what good conscience people are saying all over the country with the anti, you know, rallies centered around white supremacy. You saw the whites speaking back to this. We saw individuals on every side of the color line and gender line speaking back to this. And it's just such a blessing to have a format like today on WPR where we're going to have various opinions. But I'm not looking to the president to steer the country in the right direction. I'm going back to what the founding fathers articulated when they said, we the people.
We're talking with Chad Dion Lassiter right now, national expert on race relations and a professor at Westchester University, with us to give us analysis of the violence over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Chad, looking at the election of Barack Obama 8 years ago, some people began to talk then about a post-racial era, but we also saw at that same time some nascent racism emerging, which was surprising to some people, probably not surprising to other people. So what is your take on what Obama's election may have meant for the politics of race in America?
I think at one juncture, it kind of supposed that we were transcending race. On the other extreme, post-racial is still a mirage. I do applaud the president in one sense, even though I provide a critique for the president. I do applaud the president in one sense when he verbalized that some of the behavior that we see was a long, protracted history that didn't have anything to do with him or Barack Obama. But we do know over the past 10 years, 8 years of the Obama administration and the 2 years leading up to the Obama running for president, we saw a lot of mean-spirited behavior, a lot of bigotry, a lot of discrimination, everything from calling Michelle Obama anything but who she is, which is a beautiful woman, not just a black woman, but just a beautiful woman, beautiful women on every side of the color line. And so we saw that type of behavior. And then what Trump did was he emboldened it with the birther claims. He emboldened it with the let's build defense, the xenophobic behavior, white male dominance. His cabinet, for some, was made up of individuals who we say alt-right, but is a white supremacist organization. And so what you say in theory and then what you do with policy, actually, when it converges, people get the real Donald Trump.
I want to take a caller now. We've got Lonnie joining us first in Neillsville. Lonnie, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, first off, I do want to denounce the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists for their actions. They were uncalled for, but I'm kind of wondering why there's two sets of standards here, because nobody had a problem when Obama invited the Black Lives Matter to the White House. I mean, they're punks and thugs just like the white supremacists. There was no outcry then. And then when Obama went call out the people in the San Bernardino shootings and the Pulse nightclub as radical Islamist terrorist, how come there was no outcry then?
Lonnie, thank you for the call. Chad.
I think, Lonnie, you raised some really great questions. I think that in our democracy, one thing that we should do is refrain from calling people punks or thugs, just like the president called the white supremacist losers. I don't think we do that. I think when we look at Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter actually was created in defense of some black and brown people being killed by some white police officers with their hands up, no weapons, with impunity, just similar to the historical aspect of the Black Panthers being established, not to take down white supremacy, but to speak back to white supremacy. So in our democracy, we do a lot of this. And I'm not saying, Lonnie, that you strategically try to get on this call with your analysis to do this, but we've kind of mixed apples and oranges. When we look at Black Lives Matter, it was speaking back to the challenges. Anywhere in United States of America, if black and brown people assembled with torches, with weapons, they would call in the National Guard, if not paramilitary force. In Ferguson, this was a peaceful demonstration because of Darren Wilson killing Mike Brown, and you saw a military force. In Charlottesville, you did not see a military force, and therein lies the white privilege that most Americans should be aware of, but we're in denial about.
Chad Dion Lassiter is joining us right now. He's a national expert on race relations and a professor at Westchester University. He's with us now giving us analysis of the violence over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia.
And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'd like to hear your reactions to this weekend's events, what you hope to see, fear to see going forward. What do you see happening in the politics of race in the United States? What do you think of political reaction from the president, from senators and others? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our discussion and get to more of your calls in a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with national race relations expert Chad Dion Lassiter, looking into the violence over this weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, after white supremacist protesters clashed with counter-protesters, injuring at least 34 people, leaving one woman dead.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. How is your community reacting to what happened over the weekend? What would you like to see happen at the federal level in response to the violence? And what do you think the weekend says about the politics of race in the United States and where it stands today? You can call us at 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take another call now. We've got Mike joining us next in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This thing about race, I remember President Obama's inauguration. I said, oh, good, finally, maybe we're getting rid of it. But then, too, all of a sudden, there was racist acts all over the country. This is not Donald Trump's fault. Pretty much every elected Republican for the past 8 years has been race baiting all the time. Okay? Lazy man. The things they call Michelle Obama. You know, this air that immigrants are taking away from white people, that white people's plight is because of dark people. Let's call it what it is, okay? This isn't Donald Trump.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for that call. And Chad, do you agree on any degree with what Mike had to say? Do you think there has been sort of fanning of the flames of racist resentment in the country? Mike says over the last 8 years.
Oh, yeah. And if you heard me in my before mentioned analysis, I see this as being something that has happened over the past 10 years. I love the passion in which Mike spoke with. I just partially disagree that Donald Trump is part of it. Donald Trump, when he ran on a campaign of xenophobia, homophobia, transphobia, divisiveness, white supremacist ideology. He had his pulse on the country. He understood that white male dominance and whiteness in and of itself was being threatened, and that whites, some, had fear that they were going to be the permanent minority, not the permanent underclass, because power still rules our empire. But he's right from the perspective of historically, the challenge has always been in our democracy, this virus, this disease called white supremacy and institutional racism, and we really don't want to face it. I have some problems also with the police in Charlottesville because they actually just stood there and they did not engage in trying to make sure that they, you know, intervene with some of these behaviors. And in the past, we've seen individuals on the other side of color line lose their life to a wallet, to having their hands up with no weapon.
and we've heard the police spokespeople in Charlottesville saying it might not have looked like the police were doing things. You couldn't always tell from the press coverage, but that they were involved in breaking up the struggle there. Do you see that point? Do you see that they might have been doing more than it looked like?
Actually, the people who were on the ground, some of my journalist colleagues in the city of Philadelphia and Chicago, in Detroit, Washington, D.C., articulated to me that from what they witnessed, for those who were on the ground covering the story, they actually did not see the police engaged in the same manner that we've seen them when they were in Ferguson, when they were in Baltimore. And I just don't want to make this one of those things where it's black and white, but also when you see black and white students in Cal Berkeley, you know, saying Black Lives Matter. In China, they're saying Black Lives Matter. And so this notion that we want to give these individuals a pass, one of the things I think we're not exploring is that they weren't just neo-Nazi sympathizers and white supremacists. They also double as counselors, social workers, doctors, firemen, firewomen. And so these are individuals who live in our community.
I want to ask you something, Chad. Is this, we've been talking about the history of this. Do you see this as white supremacy being rebuilt anew from the ground up? Or is this the same lineage of white supremacy that Martin Luther King Jr. was fighting in the civil rights movement?
That's a great question, and I will go out on a limb and simply say I think this is just a new generation of white supremacy. I don't think it has the old playbook where we're looking at, you know, the Ku Klux Klan and hoods and things of that nature and robes. I don't think it's that. I think it's in our policies. I think it's, you know, driving while black. I think it's, you know, not just racism just doesn't impact black and brown people, but white supremacy also disadvantages, you know, whites as well. I think this is a new generation because it's more covert. And so it's in our policies. It's in, you know, the way we run the justice system, the Department of Justice. It's the way we do fair housing. And it's the way we do, you know, business within the police departments. And so it's definitely not what King and his cohort of colleagues on every side of the color line saw. It's something entirely new. This prison industrial complex is worse than it was during King's time. And this military industrial complex is worse as well. And lastly, I would say that the only similarities I see from that era and this era is that when King spoke about the triple evils of poverty, militarism, and racism, it's the same thing that we're faced with here in the 21st century.
Just quickly before we get back to calls, do you see the differences that you just laid out there? Do you see that as making this more difficult to counter or to work with? Or how do you see it? On what level?
I struggle with that. I agonize with that. One of the things I do know is that with the advent of social media, you can mobilize for hate, but you can also mobilize for justice quicker than you could in previous generations and in previous eras. I think it's structural. I think that, you know, we can't get distracted. We should be concerned about Charlottesville. We should be concerned about the two police officers or the two state troopers who lost their lives and the other individual. But we also need to look at this from a structural and institutional standpoint. It's our policies. They can chant all they want, but it's the policies that are damaging our democracy as well.
I want to take Gary next in Rhinelander. Gary, hi.
Hi there. Hey, I definitely do not condone any kind of violence when someone disagrees with another. I just have a little bit of different take, meaning that I believe a lot of this uprising, yes, began or sparked because of the Robert E. Lee statue being taken out of a park, and that the bureaucrats decided to agree with some groups that decided that that was not something that we needed in the parks. And this seems to be something that's been happening over the last several years.
So, Gary, you think it should stay?
Excuse me?
Do you think the statue should stay?
Yes, I do, for one only reason. It's history. It's history of showing, yes, the bigotry as well as racism and such, but it also stands for what we were at one time. Let's get another statue in there that will show, hey, what we are in the year 2020 or where we are today, that what we stand for today.
Gary, thanks a lot for that. And Chad, is there something to that? Do you think that history is not sanitized? It's messy. There are things that we're ashamed of in it. And that doesn't mean that we need to remove it. Do we need to add context like Gary is saying?
I think we should add context. And Gary, if you're still listening, please tweet me at Chad Lassiter. I'd love to keep a conversation going with you. I think Gary is absolutely right, because it's similar to the N-word that runs rampant through Mark Twain. That was part of history. That was part of the Southern, you know, roots during that time. I wouldn't want the N-word to be removed from a classic like Mark Twain. I don't believe we create another statue, but to Gary's point, I think we leave these monuments that some perceive as hate up, and we have a marker that has a teachable moment to teach people something entirely different. Now, I know I may take some flack from that nationally from some of my colleagues on every side of the color line who see the Confederate flag and who see statues, or down at Princeton University, Woodrow Wilson's name is on buildings, and some students did a sit-in with Black Lives Matter. And also there were some Asian and African students as well as Latino students who had a problem with Woodrow Wilson's name being on several buildings down at Princeton University. But I think that those things remain, and we have conversations about them. That was part of the history. But I'm also okay if individuals want to fight to take down Confederate flags and want to remove statues. I just think they serve as, you know, teachable moments, and it tells us about our history.
Thank you so much for that call, Gary. And just briefly, Chad, as we wrap up, CNN is reporting that white nationalists are planning another rally in Texas in September. What do you think states and police and citizens can learn from Charlottesville to face what's coming next?
I think in our democracy, we have to really look at this notion. I'm certainly not an expert in constitutional law, but this whole freedom of speech, and we say that you can hide hate speech behind freedom of speech, I think that becomes a challenge. I think that, and that's what I worry about, you know, is that whole aspect that people can show up and they can say things and they can spew out their bigotry, their racist ideology, their homophobic ideology. This was an act of terrorism. We don't need to humanize the young man who mom articulated that he has one black friend and he drove the car and ended up killing an individual. That was evil. It was an act of terrorism. If it was a Muslim, we would be engaged in all sorts of Islamophobia. But I think for upcoming colleges, they still should have anti-protesters against the rhetoric, and it should be civil. But also we should have a police force there, and we should have some people who do the work of intervention around hostile situations and conflict resolution in the crowd. But I think that when it gets to the point of hate, these type of rallies need to be shut down.
Chad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Chad Dion Lassiter, national expert on race relations and a professor of race relations at Westchester University in Pennsylvania.
Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. Now, if the Trump administration follows one of its plans, Medicaid will be rolled back drastically, potentially over the next several years. Under the Obama-era Affordable Care Act, more people have access to Medicaid, and the Trump administration has highlighted that it's cost the government billions.
But the expansion might be saving the government money in other areas. A new UW study found that states that increased access to Medicaid had fewer people that needed federal income assistance.
Marguerite Burns is one of the co-authors of the new study. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Marguerite, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, this centers around one particular type of federal aid, SSI, a particular disability-oriented aid, I think. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. So the SSI program, Supplemental Security Income Program, is a federal means-tested income program. It's the largest means-tested cash assistance program in the country. And it serves three distinct populations. It serves non-elderly adults with disabilities. These are work-limiting disabilities, children with disabilities, and elderly individuals with very low income. And relevant to the Medicaid expansions, typically when an individual becomes eligible for SSI, they automatically become eligible for Medicaid as well. So we were specifically looking in our work at the population of childless adults, non-elderly adults with disabilities.
And when you started this study, what were you setting out to try to figure out?
So we were interested in understanding to what extent there were interactions between the programs, between Medicaid and SSI, and how expanding eligibility for public health insurance through one avenue might alter participation in a program that otherwise provided Medicaid.
So what did you find out, the main details, the main points?
Sure. So what we did was we compared states that had expanded Medicaid after 2014 to states that had not, and we compared the SSI participation rate in those two groups. And what we found was that in the states that had expanded Medicaid, there was a relative decrease in SSI participation of about 3% compared to those states that had not.
So that means that those states that expanded Medicaid, fewer people were using this SSI assistance.
That's correct.
Okay. Why?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So in our study, we don't have the data or the ability to identify the exact mechanism, but there is the theory behind this that's consistent with our findings is that for some individuals, obtaining Medicaid independently of SSI is preferable. And I need to give you a little bit of background
sure.
to make sense of that. So low-income adults, particularly parents, or non-parents, I'm sorry, had few avenues to get Medicaid outside of SSI. So they would have had to be eligible for disability through SSI to obtain Medicaid coverage before the expansions. And when Medicaid expansions have different eligibility criteria. So with SSI, to be eligible, in addition to having a serious health condition, one also must have assets below $2,000 and income far below the poverty level. So the eligibility criteria to obtain Medicaid through the expansions is more generous. It does not have an asset limit, and the income level is higher at 138% of the poverty level. So you can imagine for an individual with a serious health condition for whom perhaps the key value of the SSI benefit is the public health insurance that it provides, that being able to obtain health insurance while retaining greater savings or assets and while earning more might be appealing.
And people have characterized that SSI limit in income as a disincentive to work. If you would not only lose your supplemental income by making more money, but you'd also lose Medicaid, and that's maybe a profound incentive to not make more money.
Correct. It is described as a disincentive for that very reason.
So when we look at the amount of money that's being spent here on a person who is getting Medicaid by being in the SSI program versus a person who's on the new expanded Medicaid in some states without SSI, is there a big difference in how much the federal and state government, for that matter, are spending?
That is the question. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had the answer for you, but I can tell you a little bit about how we might get to an answer. Mm-hmm. So what our study does is provide essentially an important input into the equation mm-hmm. that we would need to look at to generate that answer. So what we need, we can now sort of provide an estimate of what we would see in terms of decline in participation, and careful simulation modelers like those at the Congressional Budget Office will take that kind of an estimate in addition to what those types of beneficiaries might cost the SSI program in terms of monthly payments, and be able to give us a more comprehensive view of the value of the Medicaid expansion, the costs and benefits.
We're talking to Marguerite Burns, assistant professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at Medicaid, SSI, apparently the expansion of Medicaid benefits under the Affordable Care Act in some states has allowed some people to get Medicaid without going on SSI, and that may have ripple effects. The jury's out in some of the details there. Marguerite, I want to ask you about a state like Wisconsin, where we're kind of an asterisk. Oh, we didn't take that federal money from Medicaid expansion, but on BadgerCare, we changed the criteria of who gets covered. How do you factor that in? What do you see there?
Yeah, so in our study, we consider Wisconsin, for the purposes of our study, as an expansion state. And we do that because we are specifically looking at the population below 100% of the poverty level. And as you know, in 2014, the state of Wisconsin expanded Medicaid eligibility to all adults below that income limit. So for our purposes in this study, we consider Wisconsin an expansion state.
Mm-hmm. I want to go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is on the line in Crandon. Kevin, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I just want to say I'm a person that's on SSI, so when you guys came up out of the volume, I was really listening. For one, remember that Scott Walker did not take the Medicaid expansion and only raised the limit for Medicaid to 100% of the poverty level, which is why I'm now eligible for it. And also that just for your listeners, you don't, for the most part, at least in my own experience and most people's experience, you don't just get disability, like tomorrow. It can be a 3-year or more process. That's if you get approved. And so it's not anything. And then as far as, you know, $800 a month and change, you know, so it's not, I'm blessed to have it, and I'm blessed to have the medical care now because I had a heart attack just last month, and I was taken care of.
Kevin, thank you so much for calling in. I'm sorry to hear about the heart attack. Best of luck as you recover from that, and thank you for sharing that story. So SSI disability, Kevin's saying, not as easy to get enrolled in by any means as people who are eligible for Medicaid to enroll in Medicaid.
That's absolutely correct. And Kevin's also correct that the Medicaid program was only expanded to 100% of the poverty level in Wisconsin, as opposed to other states that took the ACA expansion and expanded beyond that. It is more difficult, definitely, to become eligible for SSI than to become eligible for Medicaid if you have the appropriate income and asset criteria. And I think that that's another point that may persuade an individual to opt for Medicaid. There's the transaction costs in terms of applying for the SSI program. If you have the capacity to earn enough money to live, then you may find Medicaid more appealing alone.
Well, thanks a lot again for that call. That SSI disability program, wanted to ask you about the intentions behind it. Why do we have it? Well, how is it supposed to function for this group we're talking about, for working age people unable to work?
Right. So the SSI program is intended to provide for the basic needs of individuals who have a disability or health condition that prevents them from working in a substantial way. And so it was introduced in the 1970s and just meant to provide basic income maintenance for that population.
And is it possible that, and this is maybe going a bit beyond your study, if people are getting Medicaid before they turn to this SSI program, that the medical treatment addresses the condition that would keep them from working enough to where they can work, and so disability isn't really their concern at that point?
I think, are you asking then, could this prevent individuals who might down the line have been eligible for SSI because of a disability? So obtaining medical care now under the expansion prevents the occurrence
exactly.
of a disability?
Exactly, kind of a chicken or egg question here. Yeah.
I mean, theoretically, that's possible. It's not something that we looked at in the study, but theoretically, it's possible.
So knowing what you know from the study, you mentioned that the next step maybe is to figure out how much money might be saved. How would you, or say the Congressional Budget Office or somebody with some big research and data crunching capabilities, how would you start to measure that?
So I think one thing that's important is to get a better characterization of the types of individuals for whom the expanded Medicaid, independent of SSI, influences their choices. And by characterization, I mean specifically what are their health conditions, and so what are their earnings capacities, and what level of payment assistance would they be receiving from SSI had they enrolled in SSI. So having a better characterization of that population is important for a more informed model to be able to estimate what are the foregone costs if those folks are not enrolled in SSI. And then one needs to make a variety of assumptions about what their Medicaid expenditures would be, whether they were or were not enrolled in SSI. So those are kind of the components that you need to work with.
We're talking to Marguerite Burns, assistant professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at a study that found that states that expanded access to Medicaid had fewer people that needed a particular type of government income assistance, SSI, the disability coverage.
You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think that access to Medicaid should be expanded? Why or why not? Has having Medicaid helped you save income, do you think? And what do you think of plans from members of the GOP to roll back access to Medicaid? Call back 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Marguerite Burns, assistant professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, Looking at a study, she's the co-author of it, it found that states that gave more people access to Medicaid saw a drop in the number of people needing federal income assistance due to disability.
You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think it's a good idea to give more adults who don't have children access to Medicaid? Wisconsin is a state that chose not to expand access to Medicaid. Do you think it should have? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And if you are on this SSI disability program, let us know how it has worked out for you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Marguerite, can we see if people in states that expanded access to Medicaid were more likely to be employed than under the previous state of affairs?
So I personally have not looked at employment as an outcome. It's a really active area of research in terms of the effect of the ACA, both the Medicaid provision and other provisions of the ACA. And right now, on average, the studies that have been published don't demonstrate significant changes in employment. However, the one study that looked specifically at individuals who report disabilities saw an increase in employment in the states with expansions relative to those without expansions.
And if we're seeing fewer people using SSI disability once they have access to Medicaid, when access has been expanded, I guess a cynical person might look at that and say, well, were these people on disability? Did they have a significant disability to begin with? Were they gaming the system in some way?
Right. And my answer is no. So it's important to remember, again, what the criteria are for eligibility for SSI. So in addition to having a very kind of rigorous medical exam that demonstrates a significant health condition, and one has to demonstrate very low income. And I think most salient for our discussion here is assets below $2,000. So that was the asset level established in the program at its origin in the early 70s. It has only once been increased. So for an individual who, one can imagine an individual has a significant health condition, meets those medical eligibility criteria, absolutely, and may have the capacity to acquire some savings or engage in work, may prefer to do so, but with a serious health condition can't jeopardize their health insurance.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, hi.
I've read recently that since the latest economic downturn that more people have actually gotten on disability than gotten new jobs. I think there is some game playing here of getting, supported by the government rather than finding a record number of people that have given up looking for work. I think it's like 90 million or something like that. It's unbelievable. And I think the system is being gamed. What about conditions like depression or, back pain, which is not due to some injury or physically visible damage.
Jim, thanks for the call. I think there have always been concerns. Are people, as I the phrase earlier, gaming the system? Are too many people using this rather than getting work? Do we have any? And there have been news stories about pockets of the U.S. where more people are on SSI disability than others. What do we know about, the legitimacy of the number of people who are on the system?
Right. Well, thanks, Jim, for your point. I understand the point that you're making. And I think that in our study, what we're comparing states that differ only on the fact that one set of states are expansion states and one are not expansion states. So if that is the one important difference, given the way that we've conducted our analysis, then any other factors, including potential gaming of the system, are netted out. So we still see that, relatively speaking, there's a response to expanding Medicaid for this population.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Ben on the line in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. I don't know. I was just on the end of the conversation. I'm a my situation. I've been on Social Security disability since the age of 25, when I almost lost my first leg from amputation possibilities. And now I'm able to go all the way to Mayo Clinic and I'm on an active transplant for a kidney pancreas there. And it just affords me the ability to stay alive. And I guess I get a little confused when I hear people complaining that there's not enough. I don't have any problem with the services that are provided to me, and I'm very thankful for what I do receive.
And so, Ben, I wanted to ask, how much is it the SSI supplemental income that you're getting that makes a difference in your life, and how much of it is being able to get, I believe, Medicaid because you're on that SSI?
I don't quite understand. Are you asking, do I feel if I'm receiving enough in a monthly payment to survive?
I guess if you had to weigh the benefits of one or the other, the monthly income or the Medicaid benefits, how important are they?
I couldn't live without one or the other.
I see.
Because there's such a, you have to plan monthly and be responsible to survive on Medicare and SSI. So without one or the other, you couldn't pick.
Ben, thanks a lot for sharing your story. And it sounds like Ben is definitely who SSI was intended for.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Ben, for sharing that. This our study is identifying some fraction of the population that is responsive to being able to get Medicaid outside of SSI. But there's no question that for some individuals, the choice between SSI's monthly income and Medicaid coverage is not a reasonable choice. And it is exactly, as you said, serving the individuals it's intended to serve.
Ben, thanks a lot for that call. So as states look at Medicaid with the uncertain future of the Affordable Care Act, from your research, and I know there's still more research to be done, but are there lessons to be taken away here for policymakers as they consider Medicaid expansion and looking at SSI?
Yeah, I think the one of the key takeaway points from our research is that it's going to be important for policymakers here and elsewhere to consider the effects of Medicaid expansions beyond the program itself and looking at the spillover effects on other public safety net programs in order to have a really comprehensive understanding of how those expansions or potential contractions might affect low-income individuals.
And you focused on SSI disability. What other sorts of public programs should researchers and policymakers be thinking about here?
So that's a great question. My focus is on the disability program. I can't really speak to what others may be looking at beyond SSI.
Thanks to everyone who called during this conversation. And Marguerite, thanks to you for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
We have been talking to Marguerite Burns, assistant professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. She joined us to talk about a UW study that found that when Medicaid became more widely available, fewer people needed federal income assistance, specifically, in this case, SSI disability. And as always, we would love to hear your stories over on the Central Time Facebook page, or you can sum up over at the Central Time Twitter zone, at Central Time WPR. Do you use SSI disability? What kind of difference has it made in your life? Are you one of the people who was newly eligible for Medicaid and were able to use that instead of SSI, the kind of core group that our guest has been talking about? Let us know at Central Time WPR on Twitter or share your story on the Central Time Facebook page.